This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the abbot of the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
This is from the Blue Cliff Record, case 24. Kuei Shan and Iron Grindstone Liu. The pointer. Stand on the summit of the highest peak, and demons and outsiders cannot know you. Walk on the bottom of the deepest sea, and even the Buddha's eye cannot catch sight of you. Even if your eyes are like shooting stars, and your intellect is like flashing lightning, still you won't avoid being like the spirit tortoise dragging its tail, leaving traces. At this point, what is proper? To test, I'm citing this old case. Look. Iron Grindstone Liu arrived at Kuei Shan. Kuei Shan said, "Old cow, so you've come." The grindstone said, "Tomorrow there's a great communal feast on Taishan. Are you going to go, teacher?" Kuei Shan relaxed his body and lay down. The grindstone immediately left. The verse. Once riding an iron horse, she entered the fortress. The edict comes down reporting that the six nations are cleared. Still holding the golden whip, she questions the returning traveler. In the depth of the night, who will go along to walk the royal road? So here we are in our waning hours of this session, which really only means that all of the session that we've done is inside of us. I think this might be the most well-attended January session I recall. It's a good way to begin the year. This pointer standing on the summit of the highest peak, and demons and outsiders can't know you. You know, when I read the teachings and what's being expressed poetically or directly in terms of instructionally, you know, I read that as what what the people at this time needed to know. What the people before that time needed to know, what the people after that time needed to know. The language changes. And so the language of each religious tradition, of each culture, of each Buddhist tradition is different. When you read the early teachings, there's a particular language, right, of the Buddhist teaching that we have to enter into. You read Tibetan Buddhist tradition teachings, there's a language that has to be entered into, and the Zen tradition, same. And so part of it is becoming familiar with that language, with the phrases, references. Some of it is just learning. Dada Roshi used to talk, he talked for many years about something that we never did, which was creating a kind of a dictionary for terms that are used in the Zen literature to help students understand. And sometimes that's really needed because they're very kind of obscure or maybe made sense at that time, but without some explanation, it's hard to make sense of them. But a lot of the references, you know, if you just really enter into it, put your mind there and get a sense of what's being spoken about, because it's not talking about, you know, it's using language to speak about something that's really fundamentally human, that happens in this journey that happens to you and me. And so here I think of these references to demons. Outsiders usually means those outside the Buddhist tradition who don't understand the Dharma, who aren't looking at things or examining things this way. But the demons, you know, appear a lot in Buddhist literature because they've been around a long time, as long as we've been around. There have been demons. And so going back into history and forces that were not understood, earthquakes, floods, storms, lightning, eclipses, droughts. How to understand them? How to explain them? What's going on? Why is this happening? And then internal forces, greed, anger, confusion, shame, jealousy, pride. How to understand them? How to explain them? Why is this happening? Well, explanations abound. There are lots of explanations. Just ask anyone. But how do we understand it? This is the essence of the Buddhist teaching, that in understanding, which comes out of both conceptual and direct understanding, then we can see things as they are. And without that understanding the basis of what is true, then those forces remain strong. And we keep being subject to them. And that has been spoken about in the teaching since the Buddha began speaking. But why would he say, when if you walk on at the summit of the highest peak, where the air is clear and there's no obstructions, the demons, you can't be seen. But why at the bottom of the deepest sea, even the Buddha's eye can't see you? What is that? And what is this with not being seen? Seeing Buddha, being seen by Buddha, is a way of expressing distance, being apart, separateness, another being, another force, one's own self-consciousness. Two, when we begin training, we enter in and so much of what we encounter is, in a sense, coming from the outside. Teachings, training, instruction, things that we don't yet understand. But it's all moving towards, it's all intended to move in one inexorable direction, home. To realize the body and mind of Buddha, of Dharma, of Sangha, of the universe, of demons and saints, of insiders and outsiders as you, your body and mind. And so to realize the self, self-nature, as empty and free, as undivided, as containing the universe, as complete unto itself, to realize other nature, phenomena, things, objects, forces, everything is having the same nature. And so, in a sense, we travel to the bottom of the deepest sea and we travel to the peak of the highest mountain and encounter the many beings in all of those places. And we encounter them as existing, but we examine their existence. How do they exist? And so they're not non-existent, but they're not utterly existent. But then he goes on to say, but even if your eyes are like shooting stars and your intellect like flashing lightning, still you won't avoid being like the spirit tortoise dragging their tail, leaving traces. So even if we've dropped off body and mind, realized enlightenment, seen the self as empty, all things as empty, that still we can be like the tortoise. I'm not sure quite what the spirit tortoise is referring to. There wasn't a note about that, but it's like the tortoises that come out of the ocean and walk up onto the sand, dig a hole and bury their, and lay their eggs. The mother lays her eggs, covers it over with sand, and then walks back to the ocean, dragging her tail, sweeping her tail to cover, sweep away her footprints. But that leaves a trail. Right? And so predators just follow that. And so her attempt to erase the traces leaves a trace. It's kind of a beautiful metaphor, right? For how do we let go and then let go still more? And so the teachings speak about going beyond in the Prajnaparamita. And then going beyond, going beyond. So when we come into practice, there are lots of dharma traces, karmic traces, right? All of the stuff. But then as we practice, we accumulate dharma traces, right? Aspects of spiritual practice, Buddhism, dharma, spirituality. And so to be that thoroughgoing. So to leave no trace is then to leave no trace of leaving a trace. This is a koan is a nice example of that. So Guishan was a late 8th, early 19th century, 9th century Chinese master. And he studied with Baijiang. Baijiang in the Japanese pronunciation, who is credited with having formulated the monastic rule in the Zen tradition. So this is early. Actually not that early, sort of later, but early for us. and then Guishan's student was Liu Tiemo, Iron Grindstone Liu. She was a nun who studied with him and succeeded him in the Dharma, and then established her own teaching monastery. And as is true with so many of the women in the tradition, the ones we know about, there's not a lot known about her because the chroniclers were men, mostly. I mean, there are a lot of men that we don't know much about either, but the women in particular we know little about. So but she studied with him and succeeded him and was considered a very important teacher and a very highly developed person. And it's because of that that she was very demanding and very tough in her teaching that she was called Iron Grindstone. And there's a story where she came to visit another teacher named Zihu. And as she came to see him, he said, "I've heard of Iron Grindstone Liu. They say you're not easy to contend with. Is that so?" And she said, "Where'd you hear that?" And he said, "It's conveyed from left to right." And she said, "Don't fall down, master." And then it said that he drove her out. And later a master said, Zihu's stick that he used to drive her out had eyes. He had authority to take the staff in his hands because he was the teacher of that monastery. He says, "But beneath Iron Grindstone's skin, there was blood. She let Zihu wield the stick, but though she appeared soft, she had steel-like strength." And so here, this is an interesting encounter where they've studied long together. They're like two ripe plums, where the teacher, Guishan, had seen through himself, and then he saw through her. And then she saw through herself, and then she saw through her teacher. This is the way the path unfolds. And so one day she just shows up to say hello or to ask a question. And Kuishan says, "Old cow, so you've come." And I think we can take that as a term of endearment. And so here again, this language is communicating something. You've come. Simple. Here you are. You've arrived. And yet in the teachings, this comes up a lot. In the Diamond Sutra, the Buddha says, if anyone should claim that the Buddha goes or comes or stands or sits or lies on a bed, they don't understand my teachings. Why? Those who are called Buddha or Tathagata do not go anywhere, nor do they come from anywhere. Thus are they called Tathagatas, arhats, fully enlightened ones. Tathagata means one thus come, one thus gone, one who comes thus. What is that pointing to? Remember, you know, when we encounter things that are seem opaque or difficult to understand in the Dharma, first, before the Buddha even began teaching, he already said, it's going to be like that. He said, because the Dharma itself is difficult and profound, and we cannot see it with the senses. And so teaching about it, which is stepping back one step, is going to be also difficult. But we should remember that when we encounter it as difficult, that what it is speaking about is you and me. Our lives, the way we experience things, our suffering, freeing ourselves from that suffering, the world we live in, our encounters, change, living and dying. In other words, what it's pointing to that may seem dense or opaque or irrelevant is utterly relevant to everything that we experience. Because that's what the Buddha was concerned about. That was his passion. That was his imperative. That was what he was concerned about. How do we live this life freely? What is not living this life freely? And that can be a way, it has been for me, of just staying with it and trying to find a way in to something that may seem difficult. So you've come. Coming and going, arising and disappearing. In this, is there someone? Is there? The Buddha says, if anyone claims that they see me come and go, stand or sit, then they don't yet understand my teaching. They see something, but they don't see me. They see something, but they don't see Buddha. And so that's why Buddhism speaks of birth as the unborn and death as the undying, the ultimate coming, birth, the ultimate departing, death. And in that, is there someone who is born? If not, what is birth? In death, is there someone who dies? If not, what is death? The footnote to that says, where should you look to see the obscurity? Where do we need to look? Where is it obscured? When we look and see, and the Buddha says, no, you're not seeing me yet. What are we seeing? What are we not seeing? In the commentary, it says, in the path of meditation, if you get to the most essential place, are there so many things? When you get to the most essential place, are there so many things? And since all of Sesshin is serving that, think about how we we slow things down, we eliminate things. There are certain areas of training we don't engage, we turn off phones, we shorten the workday, contact is minimized, we're in silence. So outwardly, we try to create a context, an environment in which there are not so many things, because we get tangled up in that. So that then inwardly, in the path of meditation, we can experience that place where there are not so many things. That's why Dogen, the Fukan Zazenge, says, put aside your involvements. Suspend your affairs. Don't take up good and bad. Don't judge true and false. Give up the operations of mind, intellect, and consciousness. Don't measure thoughts, ideas, and views. What kind of trust does it take to do that? That which we've been doing all of our lives. I remember the first time I took a plane, and there was, I remember that before cell phones, there was a, they started to introduce a telephone on the plane. It would be in the seat, behind the seat in front of you. And it was on a cord, and you could pull it out, and for some amount of money, I don't know, because I never did it, you could make a call. But I remember the first time I saw it, there was a little advertisement that basically said, if you're not calling home or calling work, you're irresponsible. You know, it was like the planting of that seed, that if you're not constantly in contact, constantly in touch, then you're not really a grown-up yet. And so it's like our modern sickness. And so to actually not just step away so that we can't actually make those calls, but to actually step away, to let the world be for a moment, really just a moment, a day, a few days. And maybe it seems so much to ask because it's not valued in our culture, silence, stillness, inward reflection. And so Liu says to her teacher, tomorrow there's a great communal feast on Taishan. Are you going to go, teacher? Now, Taishan is about 600 miles away from where they are. So what is she asking? She knows that, he knows that. That's what she's come to do, is to ask him. Are you going to this feast on Taishan tomorrow? Old cow, so you've come. Are you going to go, teacher? It's like looking through a window, listening to a conversation between two very mature practitioners, intimate acquaintances, who are speaking a language that makes perfect sense, but isn't based in reference systems. It's based in an understanding and a language that expresses that understanding, but not fixed. They understand one another. It's like a great violinist who picks up their instrument. They know each other just by touch. These two have put away their traveling staffs long ago. They're no longer seeking outside, no longer looking for a feast to go to. But they still have these kinds of conversations. Why? Why would these two masters be engaged in such a conversation? I think of it as refining their ordinariness, to allow all of their shine to fall away. You know, there's an asking of a question where we think we know the answer, and it's not really a question. There's asking a question where we really don't know and we want to understand. And there's asking a question from within not knowing and understanding to see. How will you respond? To continue to develop ourselves. And so, are you going to go, teacher? And Kweishan relaxed his body and lay down. She turned and left. What more is there? It's like she says, say a word that leaves no trace and leaves no trace of tracelessness. Say a word that is beyond enlightenment, beyond practice, beyond delusion. He relaxes his body and lays down. In this, nothing is created, nothing is established, nothing is absent. And it's really not about resting or lying down. You could ask him, but I don't think he'll tell you. It's interesting how language, all the ways of communicating, that ordinary language, the Buddha said, can create division. It can be used as a weapon. It can be used to deceive. It can be used to numb, deaden. Language can speak of intimacy and be miles apart. Here, these two are speaking directly with their minds and body, where they speak using words and not using words. What is this, relaxing his body and laying down? The Buddha said there are four postures of practice, and we engage all of them. We sit, we do standing practice, walking practice, lying down practice. If not, you should examine where you're not practicing. But here, I don't think Kweishan is practicing. He's just relaxing his body, laying down. He's not doing this for us. He's not doing this for her. He's not doing it for himself. He just relaxes and lays down. How bare. I was studying the teachings of a Tibetan master named Barwe Dorje, who's a 14th century master. And he, I've quoted him before, he like Milarepa, would sing his teachings. And I came across something that I thought spoke to this. He says, from the fortress of delight in stillness and dislike of movement, the old herder, without hope and fear, set out and became exhausted in the valley of adoption and rejection. And the teachings speak about not having fear, but not having hope either. A frequent advice, not hoping for things to come, not afraid of things to come. And so delighting in stillness, disliking movement, we become exhausted with our adopting and rejecting. And really so much of practice for a while, a long time, is struggling with those forms of attachment and the expenditure of energy that exhausts our body and mind. And training is really very explicitly designed to help us with that. And so it is specifically not made easy. And it's specifically made so that we actually have to yield. Right? When we encounter something in training that's difficult, that we would like to be different. Much of the time, we have to yield in order to pass through that resistance, that irritation, that dislike, and realize our power in that. But along the way, we also will inevitably encounter a lot of exhaustion as we're developing our capacity. And that exhaustion itself can be a tremendous motivator. Because when we're tired, it's hard to keep it up, right? Sooner or later, something's got to give, you know, and we keep waiting for everything else to give. He says, don't accept and discard too much. Let the herder, self-awareness, stay put. Stay put. The mirage waves of these appearances, moment after moment after moment, move farther away if you thirst after them. They come back if you flee them in dislike. The radiance let the herder stay put. It made me think of the Sutra of the Buddha where he talks about the dog running after the stick. Throw the stick, the dog runs after. When you get tired and stop throwing the stick, the dog throws the stick and runs after it. And he says, you can be like the dog or you can be like a tiger. When somebody throws a stick, go after the person running, throwing the stick. Go to the source. Let's deal with this. The radiance of the five poisons in your mind is like the yellow radiance of gold. It's inseparable. These kleshas, your mind's radiance, are poisonous, yet they greatly beautify a peacock. Don't see them as mental defects to be abandoned. If you enjoy them as self-awareness, as ornaments, their radiance will arise as diverse wisdom. Now, this is the teaching of the non-duality of all things, that the radiance of the kleshas, wildness, excitement, sloth, laziness, indifference, desire, anger, doubt, are considered poisons, afflictions. Klesha means affliction. And so with the early teachings, these were to be extinguished. These were to be the fire put out. In the Mahayana, they are seen as the same as the yellow radiance of gold. Your mind's radiance. They're an aspect of their emptiness is form and form is emptiness. They are the same. How can they greatly beautify a peacock? By not seeing them as defects, to be abandoned, to be extinguished, to be distanced from. Enjoy them as your self-awareness's ornaments. Their radiance will arise as diverse wisdom. Now this is in a sense, a very advanced teaching. And so in actual training, we do, in the beginning, really concentrate on letting go, letting go, letting go, learning how to tolerate these powerful states of mind and body that can so overpower us and rule us and dominate. And so as they begin, and also we're attending to the causes of those, right? Both externally and internally. So we're trying to live in such a way that we're not fostering and riling all of that up as we learn how to practice these very powerful states, which can cause so much pain. And in our path, that's really moving towards, that's a necessary part of the path, but it's moving towards the transformation of seeing them, the poison in them becoming radiance, of rather than seeing them as afflictions, as seeing them as the radiance of diverse wisdom. Right? And this doesn't mean, you know, now cut loose with your pride and jealousy and anger and greed. It doesn't mean that, because at this point in the journey, transformation has already occurred. And one's experience of relationship with, understanding of, practice of, has gone through tremendous change, which means they are not arising in the same way that they were. And when they do arise, they're not the same. Their strength, their lasting power, their effect on others, because we're better able to wield ourselves within them. So that then we're at the poised to really see more clearly, because there is less fear, more patience, more understanding, to now look more carefully. He says, there's no reason to stop your minds coming and going. The desire to know, the desire to flee causes fatigue. Look now. You see nothing. There's nothing there. Don't look. If you rest in place, you'll see. At this point, however you look, you'll see. Because what you see, what everyone sees, is that there is fundamentally not a thing. And that is self-awareness's ornament as it arises in a thought, an emotion, an object. That is Prajnaparamita. A vivid display of self-nature. The mind is empty. It can't come or go. The restless hope for stillness, Dorje says, and the dull fear of movement. Hoping for stillness, being afraid of movement. Give up hope. Give up fear. Let the deer of mind, the mind that acts like a deer, show you that the mind is not a thing. It can't come or go. Your mind is awareness emptiness. That's its nature. It contains nothing called stillness. When the mind is still, there's nothing that you can find that is stillness. When the mind is active, there's nothing, when you look carefully, that is active. Your mind and appearances have from the beginning been unborn. Birthlessness is their nature. They are primordially pure because they have no origin. Their nature is great, primordial emptiness. This is the ultimate meaning of the Dharmakaya. The Dharmakaya is the body of reality, your fundamental body. And then he says, in all of your conduct, walking and sitting, sustain your mind through mere attention, simple, plain, deep, unadorned, uncomplicated. Rest without artifice or alteration. Rest. Truly rest. Kweishan relaxed his body and lay down. Before, there was rest. During, there was rest. After, there was rest. Liu turned and walked away. At rest. You know, we train to live. We should remember that. We train to live and we train to die. And we train to so fully integrate and allow the Dharma to inhabit our body and mind that it becomes our natural way of being. And to do that, we train. To get to that elemental place. I was thinking about, so I was working on this, I was thinking about my mother at very towards the end of her life, last day or two, we had to change her adult diapers. And I had already helped her change a couple times and was sort of checking out, is she comfortable with this? And so my sister and I were going to change her diapers. And so we let her know we were going to do that, and we took off the sheets, and we were preparing to do that. And I hesitated a little bit because I just wanted to know, is this okay with you? And she looked at me and she says, there's no sex anymore. It's just animal. Just the basics. And so we practice to die within our living, so we can live within our dying. I was watching a documentary recently with the Dalai Lama where he's talking about his own dying. And he said he felt confident that in his death, his last thoughts would be deep, heartfelt wishes of well-being for everyone, for you and me. That was how he had lived his life, and that he had every intention of ending his life that way. He said, but maybe if I die suddenly in a plane crash, then I don't know. And I thought, honest answer. Honest answer. That's his wisdom. That's his having lost his shine. He knows what his life is about. He knows that he intends to live his life, to live his vows all the way through. But he doesn't know what he will do at such a moment. Thank you for that. To let go of all artifice and alteration. It's interesting, isn't it? Kind of curious that we need all of this to let go of every artifice, every contrivance, right? And see that this, whether we're sitting here in the Zendo or we're sitting out in a field or in a living room somewhere, whether we're wearing robes or bathrobes or nude, we'll always be assuming some form, right? We'll always be taking some shape. And it will always be intended to reveal no artifice from the beginning.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about the monastery's programs, weekend retreats, and residency, please visit our website at cmm.org.